great joy to have with us today as our special speaker this day. As I said yesterday, every evolutionist's worst nightmare. We're so glad to have Dr. Philip Johnson with us. He is professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley. I mean, just think about it. It's one of the strangest come to passes in all of history that he would be at Berkeley, but we're grateful that he's there and greatly used of the Lord there indeed. He's been there since 1968. He served as law clerk two times, once for the California Supreme Court, once for the U.S. Supreme Court from 66 to 67. He was deputy district attorney in Ventura, California from 68 to 72, and from 77 to 80, associate dean at the University of California at Berkeley. He's been a visiting professor at Emory University School of Law and at the University College in London, England in the 1980s. He's written a number of books. I happen to have one with me right now, Reason in the Balance, The Case Against Naturalism in Science, Law, and Education. What a book. What a wonderful testimony in this book of how naturalism fails in all of those areas. He's also written Darwin on Trial, for which he is probably the most famous, and more recently, Defeating Darwinism. And we just are very privileged today to have him here. Last few days, he's been on our sister seminary campus at Southern in Louisville, and we're glad to welcome you today, Dr. Johnson, from the Great Tribulation into the Millennium here at Southeastern. And we're thrilled to have you here with us. In just a moment, he's going to come and give God's message for the hour. The seminary and chapel choirs are going to sing, Here I Am, Lord. And as soon as they have done so, listen with open mind and heart to Dr. Philip Johnson.
Well, good morning to you. Good morning. This is my Southern Baptist week. I've just come from 3 days at the Southern Seminary at Louisville, as President Patterson told you, and speaking at the giant Southeast Christian Church there. I'll be 2 days here with various appearances at classes and other things, and then I'm going on for 2 days at the First Baptist Church of Charlotte, where I'm going to do educational programs before flying back to Berkeley on Sunday. And then I'll be back teaching on Monday. This is our spring vacation, and this is my idea of a good vacation week. It's a strange thing in a way. President Patterson remarked that I was from Berkeley, and I could hear all of you murmuring, can anything good come out of Berkeley? And then he didn't even tell you that I'm an elder in the Presbyterian Church, which is strange. But since we've just heard this magnificent Methodist hymn, and can it be, I can see that this is a place with a very ecumenical spirit, so I'm not at all worried. But with all these strange things happening and going on, I perhaps should introduce myself, take the opportunity to do this, and to make the story of the ideas that I talk about a little bit personal. So I will do that. It's a question of where to start. So I'm going to start sort of in the middle of the story with how I got introduced to Dr. Paige Patterson. And then that'll take me to how I got introduced to some other things, like the Lord, for example. Then how I got introduced to some other things besides that, such as the study of evolution and the particular kind of teaching and lecturing work that I'm doing these days. I think it must have been on the order of 7 years ago now, 6 or 7 years, I was browsing in our excellent local bookstore in Berkeley, and I picked up a book by a New York author named Mike Bryan titled Chapter and Verse. I browsed in it there for some time in the bookstore, the way we, you know, penny-pinching cheap types will do. I actually bought the book, headed home, and telephoned Richard John Newhouse, the editor of First Things, at that time a pretty new journal in New York City of religion and culture, which I'd written for, and said, Richard, I would like to review this book as soon as I finish reading it. I know it's just the thing I want to do. And as I'm sure most of you know, it's the story of how this agnostic writer decided to do a book on Christian fundamentalists in one of their colleges. He said that the kind who really believe the Bible rather than the phony kind, or however he put it, words to that effect. And so he went to Criswell College, which at that time I don't believe I'd ever heard of, at the First Baptist Church of Dallas. And he went there particularly because they were so welcoming and so open to allow him to see whatever he wanted to see and take courses and so on. And he spent some time there, got to know the people, and wrote this fascinating book, which was critical on some points, but extremely respectful and friendly, a very fair-minded job. I learned later that he had a very hard time getting it through the editor because of that. And just a fascinating account of that experience. And there were two things in particular about the book that struck me, that made me want to write about it so much. One of them was that he presented Criswell College and its faculty and its president, Dr. Patterson, as being strongly dedicated to a position, biblical inerrancy, fundamentals of the gospel, but astonishingly, to his eyes, liberal in the education. And that is to say, it was a kind of education where ideas were tossed around very freely. And in fact, he said the professors had actually tried to get the students riled up, you know, to get them out of their accustomed ways of thinking so that they could look at other positions than they held through new eyes, so they could really understand them. Because, you know, you don't understand a position if you're only seeing it as an outsider. You have to understand it the way the people who believe in it understand it if you're going to deal with it properly. And that's what a liberal education, in the best sense of the word, is about. So he compared it, in fact, very favorably with the Bible education he had received at Columbia University in New York. You see, there where there was an orthodoxy, the naturalistic higher criticism, and nothing but that was ever presented there. They wouldn't even know of its existence. So it was a liberal education, although an education also committed to a purpose. That was one thing that interested me. The other thing that was remarkable about it was, in a way, the story of Mike Bryan himself, and how, despite the fact that a lot of his questions were answered and that he found this faith particularly attractive, he could not embrace it. And it, you know, sort of couldn't be for him. And I recognized a big part of my own history in Mike Bryan, and so I could, you see, understand it as he saw it and write sympathetically about that, and about how his personal associations, his particular position in life, and above all, his dedication to what he saw as a scientific way of thinking made that possibility just out of bounds for him. So I wrote this review, published it. You can read it any time on the First Things website or my own website if you want to. Out of that publication, a lot of friendships grew, as is often the case with my writing. Mike Bryan loved the review. He became a friend and has been in touch with me ever since. And then sometime later, when I was at Southern Methodist University speaking at a conference, I took the opportunity to go over to Criswell College and meet President Paige Patterson and Professors Danny Aiken and Jim Parker in particular, who were featured in the book. Well, I've kept contact to some extent over the years with some of them, particularly Jim Parker. Then it just happened now that this month a lot of invitations from Southern Baptist institutions came together all at once, as, you know, these things have a way of happening. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was in Dallas to speak at a fundraiser for Jim Parker's new project, a student at the Christian Center at the University of Texas at Austin, where I've often spoken. And I was in, the fundraiser was actually in Dallas. And while there, I gave a sermon at Parkway Hills Baptist Church, two of them. And by the way, I had the first experience. The minister asked if I would deliver the altar call. And I believe I am the first Presbyterian elder ever to do that in a Southern Baptist church. I also spoke at the Southwestern Seminary there. I knew I was coming to these and all. Now, before I came down to Dallas for that trip, Parker sent me an email, and he said, "Now, Phil, you know a lot of things, but you're a Berkeley professor, you know, you're outside of this world. I want to tell you something about Southern Baptists. That if you're going to speak to Southern Baptists, you must tell them how you came to the Lord. So I'd say anything you want to after that. You'll have their attention. But don't skip that." See, so I because of this good advice for local knowledge and all, I knew enough to do that. So that's so I'll tell you about that next, and how this Mike Bryan figure, you see, myself, came to the Lord. I was raised in a nominal Christian family in the Chicago area, Aurora, Illinois. I remember going to Sunday school as a boy, and it was in that climate of the 1940s and 50s in the United States where the church was sort of a ancillary to the civic world. You know, it was just part of good citizenship to be a Boy Scout and a churchgoer. It was that kind of thing. So we went to Sunday school because it was good for kids. And one of my earliest memories is dropping my father off at the golf course on the way to Sunday school. Now that had the effect that anyone would predict, the scientific knowledge of these matters. I still have an abiding interest in the game of golf. Thought at that time that that's what I'm going to do when I'm big enough to decide what to do for myself. But I went through the confirmation class at that church at the age of 12 as a deal with my mother. Too many years after that, I went away to Harvard College at the age of 17, just after my 17th birthday. All kinds of smarts at academic subjects, but not as smart as I thought I was, all kinds of immature, too. So as I went away to college, I thought, well, I'm leaving behind those small-town things. I put away childish things, including the church and so on. I'm now going into the big world, and I know what that big world is about. See, it's about a successful career. It's about getting ahead in life. It's about having a big position in business, government, or the academic world, the intellectual world. That's where my own interests took me, of those three. Finding the right to a woman to marry and, you know, having that kind of pleasant life in all sorts of ways. And I pursued that set of goals, a normal set of worldly goals that are, you know, fundamentally selfish, although you also think you're going to do some good to the world along the way, but it's not too much trouble. Maybe leave it a little better with a little social reform, something like that. And that was my view. So I happened to get a tremendously good start in professional life with all that, with a top-ranking law school performance, so that I had a clerkship with Chief Justice Earl Warren of the United States Supreme Court, says law clerk, during the height of the liberal reforming period. And now you're still more astonished that I'm here speaking to you, as Dr. Patterson lost his mind to invite this man. Well, I finished that, and I married the homecoming queen. Remarkable feat for a nerdish young fellow. very satisfied with myself. And I went out to Berkeley, California, because it was an exciting place. It's got the best climate you can find anywhere, mountains, you know, beaches. I mean, actually, I don't want to tell you folks about that. It's pretty crowded already, but it's a pretty nice place. So I went on the faculty there and did the normal things that a professor does, published papers and textbooks, and got tenure on schedule, and eventually an endowed chair, and was, doing all right as things went on. But then as I got into my mid and upper 30s, things fell apart. One after another. My marital troubles began to develop, and my marriage, like many others in that period of time, the 1970s, was gravely affected by the wave of feminist ideology that went through, particularly in the intellectual world. And things had just changed enormously. It was very rocky for marriages that were made under earlier circumstances and expectations. And I discovered that the academic life and success that I'd had wasn't really as satisfying as I'd thought it would be. And it's, of course, is a common story of worldly success. You see, once you get it, you wonder why you wanted it so much. Is this all there is? You've heard that story, I'm sure, many times from people who have been disillusioned by, not by failure, but by finding that the kind of success that they thought they wanted really wasn't what they wanted after all. What I discovered was that the academic world that I knew was largely a system of spinning wheels, of word games, of intellectual contests that nobody was watching. Got tired of publishing journal articles that nobody was reading, academic end games that seemed to me to be unsatisfying and really were not doing something important in the world. And so I had that sort of restless spirit from this. And then perhaps the decisive moment, I'd say, in a way, the great turning point of my life was that one night my wife told me that she was going to leave and go off and join an artist group elsewhere, that I was going to have the kids. We had children 11 and 9 at that time, and that's what she wanted to do. And I fell in with this readily, because of the way things were going, it was kind of the logical culmination of what had been happening, so I wasn't inclined to resist this. And we agreed we would tell our children the following night, when each of them would tell them separately. And during that week, this was the spring vacation week of that year, just about 20 years ago, my 11-year-old daughter was attending a vacation Bible school with a neighboring family that had invited her. We were not churchgoers. She needed to have a parent come with her for the final night and wanted one of us to go. Her mother didn't want to go. She was raised in a very conservative Christian family, Missouri Synod Lutheran, which I'm still very close to, that family. And she'd been in rebellion against it, and still was, and still is, and didn't want to have anything to do with the church. I didn't feel that way. You see, I didn't have any real rebellion, I was rather sympathetic to Christianity. I liked to read C.S. Lewis and all. I just thought I was a Mike Bryan type, you see. It wasn't for me. But I thought it was a respectable enough thing for other people. You know the condescending way we are, people who need that sort of thing. And so I was quite, happy to go with her. And I did go. But as I sat through that dinner in the evening, I was in what I call a state of heightened awareness. I'm afraid that's a term that comes out of the drug culture or something, but that wasn't the reason. The reason was that I knew that I was going to tell her at the end of the evening, you see, that her parents were getting divorced. And at that evening, I heard a minister preach the gospel, just give a simple gospel message with great feeling. Now, I don't remember the content. It wasn't some intellectual argument or anything of that kind where I'd have to remember the specifics. Any of us could probably reconstruct it without too much inaccuracy, just by guessing. But what I remember thinking was, he believes this, I can tell, and centers his life around the sorts of things that he is saying. And, I could, too. It was that thought. And that moment has stayed with me a lot. Now, you see, this was a Presbyterian church. It wasn't a Southern Baptist church, so there wasn't an altar call, you see, at that. Presbyterians don't do things like that. But nothing really happened. And I don't know that it would have, no matter what had happened that evening. But I saw that as the moment at which coming to Christ became a real possibility, you see, that it got on my mental map, as it were, as one of the things I might conceivably do in real life. And since then, I've always thought that in my own work, that this is the key move often for a person. That is, it's not the moment when they make a decision or give an answer. It's a moment when the question becomes real to their imagination, you see, as something that they might do. That's the biggest step in a change. So that's why I always give that as the crucial time, although I did not actually come to Christ until many months after that. That was the moment at which it was a live option in my mind. Well, I'll have to skip forward now. We can't cover all of the details. A time later, I ended up as a member of the First Presbyterian Church of Berkeley, which is one of the most evangelical congregations in a very divided denomination. That's a whole other subject. Married again in that church at the beginning of 1981. Over the coming years, developed a great interest in a question that one might say grows out of the opening of the Gospel of John, which is the text I always preach from when I use a text, and never at the beginning of Genesis when I speak on creation, but the beginning of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And as I think about that text, we can just start at the beginning. I mean, it says a great deal throughout it. There's enormous content, but just start with the opening thought. In the beginning was the Word. In the beginning was intelligence. The beginning was purpose, communication, whatever, all those kinds of things you would associate with the Word, the Logos, the wisdom, purposes of God, the speech of God. In the beginning was that. Is that real or is that unreal? Is that a comforting fantasy, you see, or is that the bedrock of reality that its position there at the beginning of the Gospel of John asserts it to be? And that's allied to another question that I like to phrase in somewhat hyperbolic terms. If the gospel is true, why are all the intelligent people agnostics? Now, I don't mean to take that. Don't be insulted if you consider yourself an intelligent person and a non-agnostic, because, of course, I don't mean that literally. But you understand what I do mean, that the intellectual world, the world of the big thinkers, of the elite media, as well as the universities and higher government circles, is utterly dominated by an agnostic or naturalistic philosophy. In the universities, we don't have a theological... We have a religious studies department, if we have anything, which is a branch of anthropology that studies the Christians along with, you know, the Aboriginal myths and so on, as a part of anthropology. And many other ways one could put this. So why is the intellectual world so dominated by the essentially godless, naturalistic philosophy that it is? Well, this line of thinking eventually led me to Darwinian evolution. During the sabbatical year 1987-88, just 10 years ago, that I spent at University College London, with a nominal title of visiting professor, but no teaching duties, a lot of opportunity to get into mischief, and nothing particular to do with myself. So I happened to pick up the literature of Darwinism, starting with Richard Dawkins, the most famous Darwinist in the world, and really a very effective evangelist for atheism, for whom biology is only incidental to the main message, which is atheism, and Stephen Jay Gould, and some of the critical literature, and began to get into the professional literature. And one night, a few weeks into this, I said to my wife around the dining table at our home next to Hampstead Heath there in London, "You know, I think I understand the main thing. I think I know what this is all about and what's wrong with it, but it would be disastrous for me to attempt to take it up professionally. Fortunately, I'm too smart to do anything stupid as that. I would be in a never-ending battle. It would consume my life. I would be attacked on all sides. It would be, you know, all-consuming." And of course, that was absolutely irresistible. So I started the next morning. A long process of writing and so on resulted in the book Darwin on Trial, which was eventually published after, you know, much difficulty in finding a proper publisher in 1991. And I have two other books since then that President Patterson's mentioned, a fourth on the way this summer, a collection of my previously published essays titled Objections Sustained. And indeed, the speaking career that is somewhat all-consuming. I've gone half-time at the university, by the way, so I can travel all the time half the year, and then weekends and, you know, a vacation week like this during the spring when I am still teaching. Now, what was it that I saw? Let's see, what was the nuts of the very heart of this problem? See, what I saw was that it was a problem of a way of thinking. The world conceives the contest between evolution and creation as a, what you might call it, the Bible facts versus the science facts. You see? You have, on the one hand, they will say, well, indeed, I can give you an example. If I find it, I can do it from memory just as well, I suppose. That a typical science text or popular science book will tell you the people who doubt evolution are Bible believers who simply get their facts out of Genesis and who do not subject them to reconsideration or investigation, who reject everything that's contrary to that and ignore scientific evidence, you see, that doesn't fit with that to belief. See, then on the other hand, you have the science side who are neutral, open-minded investigators, very much like those professors at Columbia that Mike Bryan wrote about, who investigate the facts and test hypotheses and, you know, reconsider them at all times. And so then one side has one set of facts and the other side has another set of facts. And then they debate them, and that's really the basis, and that's what you need to know about it. It's the Bible versus science, which is to say it's the Bible versus the facts. You see, and in that debate, obviously, who's going to win? You see, once the thing is phrased that way, because the culture as a whole says, when we go to, when we're sick, we go to, a medical doctor, a science. When we want to fly, even Philip Johnson, when he wants to go from Berkeley to Wake Forest, flies on an airplane that's designed by scientists and engineers and so on. So that's where we get our facts from, and that's a conclusive. Now, that's one way to look at it, you see, and if that were the right way to look at it, then that answer would be very understandable. But what I saw was that there's another way to look at it, which I think is a much more accurate way to look at the controversy. And that is that science in our culture has two definitions. And the scientific community, the academic community generally, the elite intellectual culture thinks they are the same. It thinks both definitions amount to the same thing, but they are not the same. One definition of science is the one that I've indicated in that stereotype of the Bible-science conflict, which is that you do experiments, you make observations, you do calculations, and you follow the evidence wherever it leads. You see, and that's why science had to be independent of the Bible or the popes or, you know, any other external authority, whatever, so that it could follow the evidence wherever it leads. But the other definition of science is that science is applied naturalistic or materialistic philosophy. You see, that science starts at the beginning, a priori, with the negative to that affirmation, in the beginning was the word. And it says, no, in the beginning were the particles. In the beginning were the particles and impersonal natural laws. And that's all there was. Nature is a closed system of material causes and effect, in which everything is ultimately explainable in terms of the motions of matter and the laws of physics and chemistry. That being the case, it follows as a matter of logic, without need for evidence of any kind, that something roughly like the Darwinian evolutionary scheme must be true. You see why. In fact, Richard Dawkins, the most famous Darwinist, will tell you in his doctrine of universal Darwinism that he preaches all around the world, and preaches is the right word, that if life exists on a distant planet on the other side of the universe that we can never see, never go to, never make observations of, it evolved by the Darwinian means. So he knows it without evidence, because it's the only thing that could have happened once you subtract that mind, you see, that word. You start with particles in mindless motion. You start with chance movements. But chance alone can't do the job, because Dawkins himself says that biology is the study of complex living things that look as if they were designed by a creator for a purpose. That's the definition of biology. His equally materialistic colleague, the eminent Sir Francis Crick, co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, says biologists constantly have to remind themselves that what they study was not designed, it evolved. And why do they have to constantly remind themselves of that? Because otherwise, the obvious would occur to them. Now, it keeps occurring, you see, anyway. So the job of Darwinian science, of materialistic evolutionary science, is to fill out this materialistic program, this evolutionary program, which is known a priori. And when you understand that, you see, then you understand all the details, and you understand this crucial thing that I've mentioned from a liberal education of why it all seems convincing to the other guy. And so what you need to know is not why it seems ridiculous to you, but why it seems so convincing to them. If you start out with that a priori, you see, then you're very easy to convince. It's as if I told you that I, you know, went behind out there and I dropped a coin and do you know, it fell down to the floor. You wouldn't say, where's your proof of that? You know, you wouldn't subject me to a withering cross-examination, want to call contrary witnesses. But what if I said I dropped it and it fell up and hit the ceiling? See, it would be quite another matter, wouldn't it? And you see, so for the Darwinist, for the materialist mentality, to say that a combination of mutation and natural selection, the only thing they can imagine capable of doing the designing of those complex things, to say that that did the job of creation is like saying that the coin fell down. And so that is why, for example, evidence of minute variations in nature, evidence that the average size of finch beaks in a population is a little more some years and a little less others, will be evidence to the Darwinian mind that natural selection can make birds in the first place. See, because they know it anyway, a priori. The fact that almost all the fossil evidence fails to fit in with their expectations won't bother them because out of millions of fossils, they can find a few with proper interpretation can be made to fit. It's very convincing. I like to cite one of my favorite examples is Carl Sagan's remark when he learned that the long time scenarios of billions of years which had originally been thought required for the initial evolution of the first life forms from non-living chemicals in a prebiotic soup just couldn't be obtained because life appeared very early in the history of the Earth, and before that there were meteor bombardments and everything where nothing could live, so there's a very short window of time. What did he conclude from this? The evolution of life must be much easier than we had supposed because it happened so rapidly on the early Earth. You see, it's perfectly logical if you look at it through those lenses and that chain. So the question then, in my mind, became not should we follow the Bible or the evidence, which is that Bible science paradigm way of thinking about it, but should we follow the evidence or the materialist philosophy? And from this leads a great movement that's been founded and that's I don't have time to tell you all about now, but that in which our goal has been to change the question. You see, not to preach answers, but to change the question that people are asking. You see, so that they get to that moment where the question becomes real to them. By legitimating the critique of evolutionary naturalism in the mainstream secular academic world. And that's what I do when I speak at scientific conferences and when I speak at the secular universities and so on. And then in the Christian world, to get a broad-based understanding of this approach and of the importance of getting the right questions asked, so that instead of fighting with each other about subjects like the age of the Earth and, you know, the old Earth and young Earth position, instead of even on a broader scale of the importance of the Bible versus the teaching authority of a church or whatever, that God believers of all sorts are led to agree that the very first question to ask before we get to the others is God real or not? Is God real or an illusion? Is it true that in the beginning was the Word or in the beginning were the particles? Did God create mankind, or, as Darwinian evolution supposes, did mankind create God? Create God, that is, out of the resources of their imagination. When not knowing that their true creator was Darwinian evolution, they imagined this father figure in the sky. You see, to say that that is a very important question, you don't even have to give the answer to it. You see, you just have to make it one of those questions that's real to the mind of the questioner. It will answer itself. Don't worry about that. You see, the truth will come out when it has a fair chance to, because in fact all the evidence is against this alternative naturalistic mechanism of creation once you have the question right and once you don't identify it with a very definition of science. But see that it's only a possibility that some people have suggested that can be tested against the evidence, and then we'll see that it will fail the test. So it's just a matter of getting the right questions asked, getting them on the table, and getting the thinking straight. And that's the first step, rather than to tell people all of the, really any of the answers, but especially all of the detailed answers. because that just lands you back in that old paradigm, arguing about the facts, and you don't get anywhere. Now, obviously there's much more to the Christian faith, there's much more to salvation than in the beginning was the Word. One has to go on to the rest of that, the rest of the gospel, and all of that. But you see, it's that crucial step that makes the rest of it possible, that makes the rest of it part of people's mental map. If the Creator isn't real, then sin isn't real. We can't be out of the right relationship with an imaginary Creator. You see, and so all of the rest of it doesn't fit into the plausibility structure. I think eventually we want to get people the question I want to see them asking themselves and trying to answer is the question Jesus put to his disciples. Who do men say that I am? And who do you say that I am? You see, again, if the Creator is not real, if Darwinian evolution is our true Creator, that question is answered before it even gets on the mental map. So it's a matter of bringing those questions forward. And again, that's an education that's liberal in the true and positive sense of that word. I like to say that I'm a liberal in that sense, you see, of believing that all the questions should be on the table and that the right questions should be asked, and then we should trust the truth to fend for itself and not try to defend it with our puny defensive measures because they just don't work. I also like to say I'm a fundamentalist. You see, in the eyes of the world, the meaning of that word has been reversed. A fundamentalist, as the word says, is somebody who gets to the fundamentals and sticks with the fundamentals and doesn't get distracted into other matters, important as they may be down the road or for other purposes, but sticks to what is fundamental and gets that right first. In the eyes of the world, you see, fundamentalist has come to signify somebody who does not have that sense of priorities, but is fighting over details, jots and tittles and so on, instead of the big central issue. So I say, it's not that all the other things are unimportant. All of the things you do are important in their way. But you have to get the first step right before you can take the second. You have to begin with the Word. And I'm glad to see that that's what's being done here under the kind of leadership you have. I'm glad to see that the Southern Baptist changes and revolution have created a vibrant intellectual community with that dedication to the faith and also openness to the world of ideas and desire to learn not just how we want to think, or we should think, but how the other people think, because that's the only way to reach them effectively. That's the great commission for our time, the commission to our own society and to those unfortunate intellectuals within it who thought that they were too smart, that they didn't need that crutch, but who hopefully will discover, as I have, that they need it just as much as anyone, if not more, so that they can find the truth that they were looking for in the wrong place, that they can be turned to the right place and have a chance to find it and to join it as we have done. Well, that's my message, and thank you very much. I believe I'll turn it over to Dr. Patterson for the closing question.